yesterday's price is not today's price. Yesterday's price is not today's price.
The Sock Jig Sneaker Podcast doesn't have any stories about buying Jordans at Modell's for $49. Welcome to the Sock Jig Sneaker Podcast. I'm your host, Sock Jig. You can follow me on Twitter and on Instagram at Sock Jig. First off, I wanted to thank everyone who follows me on Twitter and got me to 10,000 followers. You know, I'm really humbled by that. I think it's really cool. As I said on Twitter, I started this account just basically to get my sneaker opinions out there because I didn't really think my opinions or what I thought was properly represented out there. So there was a tweet by at Lucky Botter, who's got a really good YouTube and Twitter as well, and a podcast as well. He was asking, why are people scared of showing their face who are in sneakers? Surely no one really cares what you look like, who you are. I kind of replied to that. It's so my coworkers don't know that I tweet about sneakers all day. And really, that's kind of how my account started. So I was just wanting to separate the personal account from a public one so I could kind of freely talk about sneakers without worrying about that kind of stuff. You know, one of the original goals was to make a blog, and I tried that and realized it wasn't that much fun, so I stopped it pretty much pretty quickly and kind of just put the content that I wanted to create on that blog just on Twitter as, you know, the year-end lists and things like that that I do. But, you know, as the account kind of gained steam, I just kept it the way it is because it just kind of fits. My goal here was never to become some sort of sneaker influencer and have brand partnerships and, you know, work at Complex or things like that. And really, if you want clout, your name and face has to be out there. You know, I've released some info about myself here and there, you know, that I'm brown, that I'm 43, you know, almost 44. And really, that kind of answers the first part. You know, my window for chasing clout or working at Complex is long closed. And really, I don't want the pay cut to work at Complex anyways. So mostly I use this kind of stuff just to have fun, to get my jokes off on Twitter. And if you see how I act on there, I've stayed true to that. The podcast and the socks and everything kind of grew from that organically. It's meant to be fun for me and not a business. And that's how I've always treated it. You know, I'm not out here feeding the content machine saying things that you barely mean in order to keep up with others so that I can, you know, one day be featured in what you got on the sneakers app. And I know, you know, people have those goals and that's totally fine. That's just what I'm saying is those are not my goal. So that's why I say I really do appreciate everyone who does take the time to listen to this podcast and follow me on Twitter and, you know, specifically takes the time to like and retweet and reply or DM me. You know, as a thank you, if you missed out on the OG Sock Jig socks in wash cream with the black text, and if you want a pair, you can go to shop.sockjig.com. The password is distortion, and I should have pairs available there. It's a podcast drop exclusive. So pause the podcast and go right now. But, you know, I'm not sure when you're actually listening to this, so if you try later and it's sold out or the password doesn't work anymore, just DM me on Instagram or Twitter, and either I can give you the new password or let you know if it's really sold out and kind of, you know, give you exclusive access to the next drop. So speaking of exclusive access, today on the pod, I wanted to talk about two recent articles. One is the Complex article about a leaked sneakers meeting at Nike headquarters. And the other one is from the New York Times about bots and bot mitigation and what retailers kind of really think. Basically, I'm going to go through both articles and hit on the key points, you know, read some quotes and kind of annotate and give my thoughts and opinions as I go. But first up, pickups and what's been on feet lately. On feet, since the last podcast I did, I undead socked the Fragment Travis 1 Lows. There's basically, you know, a last few sunny days here in Vancouver. And then, so I got to wear them once. So it's been pretty much rainy ever since then. At the start of the NFL season, I always wear the Colin Kaepernick Air Force 1s. So I wore those for a couple of weeks as well. But lately, I've been dealing with a foot injury and my foot was like swollen a bit. So really, the only comfortable shoe I could wear with that injury was the Presto, which is the kind of shoe I wore most of the summer. So I just wore like a GR Presto because the the upper is totally cloth and doesn't hurt when you wear it. Pickups, I picked up the Denim Tears Asics Gel MC, the red clay, the cream version. I don't have those in hand yet, but I'm always a fan of Denim Tears, and I like Asics, so I picked those up, but not the red ones. I also picked up the Quarter Snacks Zebra Dunk SB. Yes, it's pretty wild. It looks like a zebra, but, you know, so does the Yeezy Zebra. It was pretty cheap on GOAT, like $240, I think I picked it up for, so... I also picked up the Air Max 1 Pata. I got those in hand. They're super nice in hand. I'm a fan of those. I woke up at 4 a.m. my time to try to get those online. And that's probably the first time in over a year that I've woke up that early to try for a shoe. And I also picked up the Yeezy 700 Washed Orange, the Wave Runner with the orange midsole. But mostly I've been skipping or passing on drops. Sometimes I'm just like Jerry Seinfeld, where he wants to know if villas are available to rent in Tuscany. So I will log in, I will, enter the queue and just kind of see how fast stuff goes. Just so, you know, I'm up to date and seeing what's going on. For example, for the social status Dunk Mids and the Billie Eilish Jordans, I entered the queue. You know, I waited till one of the groups I'm in kind of gave the answer or so. I entered, and really it was more like I'm entering like a normal person because I wasn't right on there. I was probably like 30, 40 seconds late. And really that's the difference between buying and not buying. So I got sold out messages on those. But then again, I was just seeing what's available in Tuscany. Other recent releases like the Banana Knit Yeezy Runner. That's a Yeezy Supply only thing. I didn't even try for that. There's the Off-White. Speaking of bananas, there was the Off-White Air Force One Shock Draw, if that's a new term that's come up. Again, sneakers, I don't try because I don't have access. There was that Jound Navy shoe. I was talking about this on Twitter. That's like a one or two outfit shoe for so much for $260, $290 US shipped. So not very Joundy in my opinion. So that was a skip as well. All right, I wanted to talk about this Sneakers Complex article that came out last week. The article is called Nike Shares Sneakers Data, Plans, Concerns in Internal Meeting. So the article is about an internal meeting that occurred at Nike recently where they're addressing the state of the sneakers app and how it's a source of frustration for consumers. The article is basically slides in a presentation that were leaked to Complex. And the story was written by friend of the jig, Brendan Dunn. I wanted to go over the main points of the article and then kind of give my thoughts as I'm talking about each point. But first, I wanted to say none of this is really intended as a slight against Complex. You know, if they get leaked data, they're going to report on it. But I did want to say that there's always going to be this kind of cozy relationship between brands and the media outlets that cover them. You saw this recently in the NFL where there's a story about how ESPN reporter Adam Schefter had a leaked email where he appeared to give full editorial control to an article he was writing to the Washington football team's GM at the time. But, you know, that email did read as if it was like half joking, but it really did show how close they were working. And even Joe LaPuma has said on an early episode of the Complex podcast that they have once nixed a cover story, a magazine probably, because Nike would have disapproved of it. And, you know, even if you listen to current episodes of their podcast, they openly name drop people and people they know in at certain brands and stuff. And it kind of just shows how cozy they are. And really, it's not a surprise. This is how almost all coverage works these days, you know, in the NFL and even in fields like tech and video games. Well, you know, that's not me. I'm beholden to no one. I don't work at a brand. I might know some people here and there affiliated with places, but that's about it. I'm not on a private jet going to New Balance headquarters or anything like that. So these are just my thoughts and what I inferred from the article about what Nike said, what they didn't say, and what I think Nike's intentions were. Perhaps my inferences here are incorrect. In which case, Nike is free to leak more Google Slides and correct the record. But I think my track record on sneaker takes stands on its own. So the article starts off about how Nike doesn't want to alienate sneaker collectors by their launch tactics. You know, it's interesting how they highlighted collectors here. There's a quote, "High heat, hype is killing the culture, and consumers are migrating towards New Balance and smaller independent brands and other luxury brands." I'll talk about the culture a little bit later, but what I found interesting at this part was New Balance being named directly. No other brand was mentioned by name. There's no way Adidas would ever be mentioned in this article like this, even if they did have an incredible, you know, not an easy year. When someone is a huge market leader and they acknowledge a competitor, it's basically elevating that competitor to being in the same league as you. So New Balance being named here was very interesting to me because it's saying, hey, they are making good product and people are gravitating towards it. Even if New Balance is not making a ton of pairs and how they're releasing pairs is not always the best either. So the article also talks about how you know, the concerns in this internal meeting that sneakers had, that Nike had, extended to neighborhood retail partners, the neighborhoods in quotes there, which includes like top tier boutiques and collaborators like, say, Union. The article doesn't really go on and give specific details about what they want to do about in-store, but we can infer here that they're interested in how stores release, both in-store, online, and also like launch events around a release. So the real star of the article is the sneakers global VP, Ron Ferris, who has most of the quotes. He attributes the fatigue to low perception of fairness. A quote from him is, "Our community is becoming disenfranchised by our low fairness numbers. Our fairness numbers are not where they should be. They're at like mid-20s when they need to be in the 80s. He goes on to say, "We need to ensure that 80% perceived member fairness through the lens of access, bot mitigation, inclusion, clarity, and accountability." So let's break down what he's saying. This doesn't mean that they want 80% of the people to win. And right now, you know, mid-20s are winning. That's not what it says at all. It's not outright said, but basically what this implies is they're keeping track of what people's perception of fairness is. This could be surveys or some sort of calculated score that they're using lots of metrics. But at the end of the day, they're coming up with a score on what the people think is fair. And right now, about 25% of the people are saying it's fair. And really, they want to get to 80%, which is a crazy high goal. You know, let me take you on a tangent here. Recently, there was that Boston Off-White yellow banana Air Force One shock drop in Boston. And the shock drop info basically was leaked, and everyone, especially in sneaker Twitter, knew about it. And everyone knew you could spoof. There was no Bluetooth required. And a ton of people hit because of that. Nike was well aware that how that release was going to go. They most likely saw on Twitter themselves that that info was out there. They knew there was no Bluetooth. So that's an example of where they're aware of how a drop is going to go, but they do it anyways. But, you know, let's move on with the article. So then there's a part about gentrification. VP Ron Ferris uses an analogy of gentrification to describe how sneakers have gone from this, you know, subculture to something more mainstream. And the article says that that has disaffected groups who originally shaped the culture. Now he plans to correct the course. "We're going to shape the marketplace to reflect the community we serve," Ferris said, "especially in Black and Brown communities and Asian communities, so that we actually show and we actually give equity and inclusion to the communities that have been gentrified out and alienated by the resale market." What's funny is a friend to me said, this means they're going to start giving wins to people with foreign names on their account on sneakers. And you know, that made me laugh. That's not what it means. Oh, at least that's not what I hope it means. You know, it basically is saying the communities that made your product hot in the first place have been pushed out. And this whole asset class commodification of sneakers has, you know, basically gotten rich white kids who live in rich neighborhoods and got their expensive bots and Lamborghinis and, you know, pose for their fancy flex photos, that it's going to them. You know, the people want to hear Nike say this, but all that matters is the actions that are going to come from it. Does this mean they're going to give pairs to mom and pop shops that serve those communities? You know, the same mom and pop shops that they've basically cut their contracts. You know, one of their own designers or ex-designers, Frank Cook, he's been saying this a lot if you follow him on Instagram. That just shows how much sway even a prolific employee where an average sneakerhead might know his name has versus, you know, how much power an executive has. This line, it's, I don't know what it means. Like I said, the actions are all that matters here. Does it mean, you know, extra butter and bait are going to get launch events? Or does it mean like, you know, some sort of tokenism or, you know, symbolic showing that you're caring about this, but not really doing anything? You know, right now, Nike App has a campaign with that country club I've mentioned before. Is that not gentrification? It's a coincidence, I guess, that that country club has several ex-Jordan brand employees that work there. But, you know, forget about them. So the article goes on, talks about how much more usage there is on the sneakers app, that user base has grown. But there were some key points here in this article, in this part of the article. It said that demand within sneakers went up 70% versus last year, and Nike only met 7% of that demand. And previously, they met 13% for 2019 and 2020. The Ron Ferris VP goes on to say that not enough product is available to meet demand. You know, duh. What I found interesting here, because if it's true, Nike is basically saying that 13% of people meeting demand is the adequate hype formula. It's not 50% of your customers getting it. It's not 30%. It's 13%. It's not stated or anything, but if 13% of people were hitting it 2019, which is a great sneakers year, and 2020, but now it's dipped to 7%, then the goal is to basically increase it to 6% more to 13%. Again, this is just my inference from one line, but it's pretty, you know, I've never seen numbers like this before, so it gives some insight into how they think. He talks briefly about bots, and he said, a lot of people think it's because of bots, but he claims that Nike does a good job defending against sneaker bots. And they really do in the US, but in the international markets, not really. Obviously, this article is going to be focused on the US. So the next part of the article is hilarious to me. He goes, they want to recalibrate demand by, quote, redefining scarcity. You know, and they talk about the off-white dunks and how they were available via exclusive access and how stock was 500,000. That was interesting because, you know, for one thing, the lot numbers for those pairs were, some were regional exclusive, so there weren't a 500,000 available in the US. You know, Nike openly stating stock numbers is interesting too, because they normally don't ever do that. And what was hilarious was when the CEO in the earnings call said that it went to the most deserving shoppers, which is such a hilarious way of putting it. You know, the people who haven't touched their app in 6 months or new users, those are the most deserving users. Meanwhile, people who have had an account for 10 years, they were not deserving enough. And they call this exclusivity at scale, maintaining an aura of rarity while still fulfilling a meaningful amount of demand. All of this is just hilarious corporate phrasing. Redefining scarcity, like how do you redefine a short supply? So you're saying, let's give another term to it. Are you trying to solve the problem of scarcity, or are you just trying to redefining it? You're trying to dress it up. Because the answer to solving the problem is you have to increase supply. But like I said on Twitter, we know that they're not going to do that. We've been told so many times in so many ways that making more pairs is never the answer. They did do it here for the off-white to 500,000. And you know, they want their pat on the back for that. And that's why that number leaked. But that's not really a sustainable method for every single release that comes out. For these big kind of tentpole releases, sure. If that is enough to get the fairness number to go from low mid-20s to 80, I don't know. But this is what Nike is kind of leaking as where their starting point is. But, you know, what they're really saying is the answer is new gimmicks and euphemisms and things like that. I've always talked about how, you know, the question that Shopify asked to enter Q, it inverts the L. It basically makes you, if you don't know the answer to this question, you don't blame Shopify, you blame yourself. It's a real kind of social engineering approach to this problem. And I could see Nike doing this. Imagine that whatever Drake shoe comes out and you have to enter the lyrics to one of the songs. You would blame yourself for not knowing the lyrics, but you would praise Nike for asking. So even though you take an L, you'd be like, oh, it was great that Nike asked. My perception of fairness just went up, even though you didn't get the shoe. But the entire point of this whole meeting was users have grown tired of the current launch tactics. So we got to come up with new gimmicks and new launch tactics where it is perceived as fair. So in the last paragraph or so, they talk briefly about what Nike's action plan is, and they want better content to engage with its audience. And you see that on sneakers sometimes. They have, you know, more videos and what you got and things like that. Even though the people that they feature on that is usually, you know, ex-Nike employees and or big influencer types, you know. They want to build more fair and fun experiences around launches. Again, gimmicks. They want to work to include people who feel they've been pushed out of sneaker culture. Again, how do you reach out to someone who's not, you know, paying attention to you? And then the final quote was, it means we must listen more. It doesn't mean that we're going to be dictating culture. It means our community must dictate the culture and we have to listen to them. Almost that line I said in a previous podcast that Nike doesn't define the culture. The people who wear the shoes define the culture. And what you see is basically a lot of these brands, they've leaned too hard into thinking resale culture is the culture. They got seduced by their own StockX price. And now they're trying to walk that back a bit. When that guy at New Balance, Grandino something, was on a Complex podcast, he talked about this. And he talked about how they actively track resale price to determine if a shoe is a hit or not and how money they should make for the next one. So, you know, by all appearances and just how New Balance releases have gone this year, it still looks like New Balance is still seduced by StockX price. Some final thoughts here that I didn't get as I was going through the article. What was the point of the leak? To me, the whole thing just read that Nike wants credit. They want credit for saying that we're thinking about sneakerhead collectors. They want it out there that they're actively working on this. They want credit for how they dropped the 50 with the exclusive access. They want credit for the stock number being 500,000. They mentioned gentrification, which is a first. They want credit for that lip service. You know, and that's just how it came across to me. And a lot of that reaction on Twitter was very similar too. You know, what wasn't in the leak? What wasn't shown in these slides, apparently? You know, the direct-to-consumer initiatives, the killing mom and pops, you know, the strategy on international with, you know, region exclusive and shipping rules where you can't ship out. But at the end of the day, this was a Google Slides presentation. It was not an action plan. Saying you need to listen more doesn't mean anything, especially from an executive. An action plan is not something that shows up in a Google Slide presentation. In a lot of like sales or investor presentations, they have something called a forward-looking statement to open the presentation. It's also called a safe harbor statement. And it's usually this big legalese in the slide that no one actually reads, but the gist of it is saying, we're going to show you a bunch of stuff here, and all of it is TBD and pending. And if you're buying what we're selling, you know, if it's a sales or an investment, you have to buy based on what we currently have available, not what we're showing here. So if sneakers, you know, if Nike was showing this Google slide to the public, there would be this forward-looking statement at the beginning saying, hey, there's a lot of hand-waving going on here. Go buy your most recent sneakers L, not by what we're saying here. Because, you know, Google Slides are meant to be aspirational. If you wanted to leak something, you can totally edit it. You can make a fake one or only show portions of it and not the part, you know, where you talk about killing mom and pops. I'm curious what they'll say about gentrification 6 months from now. But more importantly, I'm curious what they'll actually do about it. Because like I said, a lot of the stuff that they talk about here, this the 50 and 500,000, that can't apply to every release. It doesn't work on a regular Jordan 1 release. It doesn't work on, you know, Nike SB. What Nike always does well are these, you know, big tentpole releases, like the 50, I guess, and, you know, an OG colorway, the Bred 4s, the Cool Grey 11, the 11 release every year, even these Lightning 4s. A shoe with a lot of history and a lot of stock and a lot of demand that's going to sell out but still be attainable. That is the goal for those big tentpole releases, as I've called them. But that's not going to happen for the Halloween, Air Force One, or any other release that's scattered in between. You know, we made some jokes about making more pairs. And like I said, we know that's not happening. You know, I said the game is the game, and that's a mantra that you can always just kind of point at. And Nike is well aware of, as I've always said, about the Adidas Ultra Boost and what happens when you do make more. You know, they made a ton. The GRs weren't as nice. The collabs dropped off a cliff. Then the audience got conditioned to just wait till it goes on sale. So, you know, Nike just reads from the playbook, don't do what Donnie Don't does. Donnie Don't, in this case, is Adidas. But at the end of the day, people just want sneakers. They want the one that they like. They know they can't get all of them, but they just want some. My friend Corey Whatever on Twitter said, you know, the real answer is they need to slowly scale up production and spend time making a GR catalog that is actually good. In one sentence, I think that sums it up pretty clearly. Will Nike actually do this? I don't know. We'll see at the next leak. The other article I wanted to talk about was called The Fight for Sneakers: Can Shopify Stop Sneaker Bots?, which was in the New York Times. So again, just like the other article, I'm going to go over the main kind of points that were made in the article and then kind of annotate as I go, give my thoughts. But first, I wanted to talk about this theory called the Gell-Mann amnesia effect theory. And this theory was actually coined by Michael Crichton of Jurassic Park fame. And he was previously a physicist, and so he named this theory after his friend, a physicist named Murray Gell-Mann. So how he describes it is, when you open a newspaper to an article on some subject you know well, you read the article and see the journalist has absolutely no understanding of either the facts or the issues. Often the article is wrong and it presents the story backwards, reversing cause and effect. I call these wet streets cause rain stories. He goes on to say, and then you read with exasperation or amusement all the errors in there, and you turn the page and read the next story, but that story you read as being very accurate. So, you know, I just want to bring this up because sometimes, you know, when reading a complex article, I know that they're going to be talking to sneakerheads about sneakers. But when reading a story about sneakers in the New York Times or even Business Insider, you know that there's often going to be mistakes and a bunch of bullshit in there. So I approach this article assuming that there's going to be errors and other things wrong in there. So the article starts off in 2019 and with Bodega and their No Days Off 997S drop. So I'm just going to highlight the things that I found interesting in there, the things that we might not have known the specifics about. So in that part, they talk about how 60% of the stock went to bots. And they say, you know, someone even bought before the product page was even loaded. And 200 pairs went to the same apartment building in New Jersey. You know, that explains why New Jersey is often the first zip to be banned in on Yeezy Supply as well. So that's how the article kicks off. And, you know, my first thought was, did Bodega cancel all those pairs? It doesn't really say. They might have kept them, but they didn't reschedule a drop. And I've mentioned this on here before. If your Shopify is configured to auto post charges, if you cancel and refund, then the merchant is not refunded the 2.9% processing fees. So there's no incentive for a lot of stores to cancel and refund. If it costs them money, they're not going to do it. Or, you know, it might be they have it configured and they just don't want to spend the time going one by one through them all. So it talks a little bit about the world of resell and botting. You know, for the average person, you got to set up a StockX and how sneakers go for a lot now. But it very quickly gets to this key point, which I was surprised at. It says, quote, to most customers, bots are the bane of online shopping. But for sneaker brands and retailers, the relationship is more complicated. Bots are key to creating the artificial scarcity that makes sneaker valuable and in turn makes a brand seem cool. It all raises a big, difficult question. If the bots lose, who wins? Yeah, you know, I'll get to that quote a little bit later at the end of this, but I thought it was interesting that how it went directly to that and, you know, not a bunch of fluff. But anyways, the next section is a bunch of fluff. It talks about, you know, the history of Jordans and SBs and Kanye and how shoes used to be available, but now these days they're, you know, sneakers are a commodity, you know, yada, yada, yada. There's a section about StockX and StockX prices on the graph chart, and they call it a swoosh curve. Basically, you know, just picture the graph chart, and before a drop, the price is really high, and then going up to the release, it's dropping, And then over time, you know, it dips to its low. And then over time, just like a check mark, it's going steadily up, which is, you know, a normal for some pairs of shoes. As dead stock pairs dry up, there's fewer and fewer on the market. And the example they use is the Black Cement 3. So when they present the swoosh curve like this, it is obviously the thing that happens on, you know, Black Cement 3s or Bred 4s or any good shoe. You know, this pattern is not the pattern for all shoes. You know, a Black Cement 3 is not an average shoe. It's quite possibly the most wearable Jordan ever made. And you see this pattern a lot on a lot of older Jordans that have history. You know, and that's why people who have the capital go after every Jordan 1 or 3 or 5. Even if they're currently bricks, they know that you wait a year, wait 2 years, you can make some nice profit from them. So back to the article, it talks about Bodega and how they went from, you know, in-store releases to online. And then after that No Days Off release, they decided to, you know, get Shopify involved and, you know, get some bot mitigation. So this is where enter Shopify. And there's a brief section about Jean-Michel Lemieux, also known as JM Wind on sneaker Twitter. He's quoted as saying, "I'm a sneaker celebrity without being a sneakerhead, mostly because I've got to protect their platform. I know more about bots than maybe anyone on this planet because I've had to reverse engineer them to understand how they work." You know, JM Wind is definitely a developer, but, you know, I'm not exactly sure how much coding CTOs actually do. In a lot of places, if you're on the management track, your GitHub access is taken away. But so I don't know if he's being accurate here or not. I've always just assumed that CTOs, you know, have developers that work for them and they get the updates in meetings. And that's about it. So they describe, you know, how the kind of stuff that we see on Big Drops, slowing bots down to human levels, how they'd explain it with puzzles and one-off defenses and things like that. Then it goes over to CyberSoul and Lucas Titus. There's a nice shot of him at his home in London with a nice view and everything. And some notes here from the article that I didn't know. It says that Cyber is limited to 5,000 users. They talk about how for the Sean Wotherspoon 97.1 drop on Kith, Cyber took all 700 pairs. You know, that was 2018 or 2019 or whatever. And it talks about the cat and mouse game between Cyber and, you know, Shopify, JM Wind, and their kind of friendly Twitter rivalry as well. There's a quote in the article. "Mr. Titus said he understands the frustration some sneaker buyers may feel about bots, but as he sees it, he's merely providing the tools that people want. That includes retailers who have seen bots generate demand for their products." And, you know, yeah, you're providing a service, sure, but no one's going to say, "I like money. I'm doing this because I make a lot of money doing it." But he kind of snuck it in there that, hey, maybe the retailers like it too because I'm creating demand for their product. So then it goes back to Bodega and it talks about their 990 V3 drop from earlier this year. It talks about how it dropped with a new domain and a question. And then it talks about the site errors that occurred. And I can't remember exactly what happened, if Shopify just died and you were just getting errors on each page, or if there was H-CAPTCHA errors and that was the choke point. In the previous podcast, I probably talked about it, but I just can't remember right now. In the article, they say the error was caused due to routine system maintenance, which is just, you know, generic speak. And it talks about how the drop took 45 minutes to sell out, you know, quote, "for which a major release is an eternity." The Bodega owner guy who's quoted in the article, Jay Gordon, he's quoted saying, "If a shoe like this doesn't sell out in less than 15 minutes, it's considered a failure. It's really disappointing because we did all this to give the ordinary customers a shot." And it's true. And, you know, we saw this with Pata and how they had their drop and they had some Shopify errors. Really, Pata has no control over that. They set up the drop, they load the stock, they have it on, you know, both domains, and they turn off the password and things like that. After that, they're assuming everything works. And so if there's errors like that, it's either totally on Shopify and how they handle scaling. So here's where the kicker of the article comes in. It says, "The slow sellout time didn't seem to go unnoticed by the resale market. Even though most of Bodega's previous New Balance release carry a significant premium to the retail price, these shoes are selling at close to retail on StockX. It's possible that if Bodega took no steps to curb bot activity, the store could have sold its entire stock of shoes to botters before the problems kicked in, because of how quickly bots complete transactions. It's depressing to think, Mr. Gordon says. At some point, you have to ask, how much time are we supposed to spend to stop people from buying our products? So this is why I brought up the original theory in the beginning, the wet streets cause rain. This kicker of this article, they totally got backwards. It's basically saying if they didn't do all this bot mitigation and just did a regular drop and bots cleaned up, regular people would have missed, then those same people would have gone to StockX and paid resell, and that resell price would have steadily gone up over time like the swoosh curve because there's fewer and fewer dead stock pairs available. The problem is the Bodega 990 V3 shoe is not a Black Cement 3. If a shoe sits for 45 minutes because of a site error, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's got a stink on it and it sucks. It means the site had an error. You know, the two things that actually determine the market price of a shoe are these little things seldomly talked about called supply and demand. I know, crazy, right? For supply, this shoe was well stocked. You know, stock was, I heard, from 16,000 to 20,000. And as I mentioned previously on this podcast, we know this because it dropped on a new domain, and most of the time, new domains start with an order number of 1,000. You know, 45 minutes after that, the last people to check out, their order number was 16,000 or 17,000. Just subtract 1,000 and you get a general idea of what the stock number was. And that's easy to figure out. You know, there's Discords with thousands of people in it. All you have to do is say, post in this thread your obscured order number. 42XX, 14XXX, etc., right? That's how you figure it out. Even if Shopify modified the order numbers to start at 5,000, it doesn't really matter. We have a general ballpark that we had several thousands that dropped, and not, you know, like 992s where you get 250 or 1,000. So we know for this shoe that there was a lot of pairs out there. The other thing, demand. Is this shoe fire? No, it's not fire. It's decent. Some friends have told me it's actually awful, and I totally understand that. It's like a two-faced shoe. In some light, it looks green. Some light, it looks brown. Some light, it looks olive. If you see it in hand, you know what I'm talking about. Of course, you might be a person who likes it, and you wear it, and that's great. I have it. I haven't worn it yet, but I like it. But the price is the price. If people wanted it, they'd scramble to buy it. Look at Union. They dropped maybe 15,000 Jordan 4s, the first two. The black one and guava ones, both of those ones are fire. And then look at the recent two that dropped. One was super limited, the Topaz one, and the Desert Moss one, which is arguably the worst colorway of the four. Guess what? Goes for the least amount, because there's a lot of people who do not think it's fire. You know, what if supply was super low on this shoe, like it was for the Pata 990 one, which is a decent comparable because that shoe is like salmon or cork colored or something. It sells for like $550 or so, and its retail was high because it's a 991. And that shoe was made in UK and dropped in really low numbers. This Bodega New Balance 990 V3 is the same thing. If it dropped in low numbers, it would resell for $550, $600, or whatever. It's not fire enough to sell for $1,000, $2,000, like Double Taps or even the Jound New Balance 992s. I've heard the same argument for the Clot Air Max 1, that it was once, you know, a grail and now it's a brick. You know, when it first dropped in the late 2000s or whatever, it probably released in really small numbers. And you know, it was a different era back then. People wore them. Very few dead stock pairs probably survived. Cut to now, they dropped a ton. And in hand, if you've ever seen that hand shoe in hand, it's not that nice. It's like, do I really want to show my toes? The fit is weird. The niceness of that shoe didn't scale to the stock numbers that they released. They misjudged that. Shoes like Jordan 4s and 11s and 1s, they of course scale because there's a built-in history and story with that. But not the Clot Air Max 1, not even the Bacon Air Max 90. But that could have been the point for that shoe. That maybe the whole point of that shoe was to make enough where they sell out and they don't resell for much. And that way the consumer is happy that they can still get it aftermarket, that they've satisfied the demand. You know, previously we talked about Nike. Nike's goal in 2019 and 2020 was to meet 13% of the demand. Maybe they have these releases where it's way higher than that, these tentpole releases, as I've called them. So earlier the quote was, Sophisticated sneaker bots are key to creating the artificial scarcity that makes sneaker valuable and in turn makes the brand seem cool. I disagree with this premise. The only thing that will make a shoe look cool is if the shoe is cool. Its price is then determined by how many are available. And yes, bots play a part in making sure that those pairs are scarce, but they know to only go after the shoes that actually people want. That's the other part that's always missed out. It's as if botters and resellers are sitting around and noticing a shoe is sitting, and then they're reacting to it. No, they usually react way before that. Before it's even dropping, they're projecting what it's going to be. Do people want it? A good reseller already knows that kind of stuff inherently. You know, some big cook group like Notify or GF&F, they can one day decide, hey, we're going to buy every Yeezy 380 on the market and take them off the market. We're going to hoard them all. And that shoe is going to be in super demand because we have every pair. That's not going to happen because the 380 sucks. Wet streets don't cause rain. So the whole article talks about this 990 V3 and, you know, fails to mention the stock numbers for it. And fails to mention that the first 997, the No Days Off, and the other one that came after it, that the stock was low on those two. It was probably, you know, 1,000, 2,000 for the first one, slightly increased for the second one, and so on until we got the, whatever, 10,000 plus for this 990 V3. It is still very much up to retailers to create demand for a shoe. Botters are not going to automatically create that for you. For example, there was this J.Crew 992 release that happened recently. If you're not aware of it, it's because J.Crew did a bad job promoting it. And is often the case with New Balance shoes, they botched the release. Most of the pairs, by the time the release was announced, were already gone because they dropped overnight or, you know, someone had a bypass or whatever. You know, stop to think, do you even know what the shoe looks like? Do you know what colors there are? But if you do, you might be one of the few people that, you know, was aware of the shoe, that tried for the shoe, that failed the shoe, and then wanted to get it. And now maybe you're paying resale for it. Like I said, the resale price is determined by supply and demand. And we usually know for 992, the supply is often 1,000 or 2,000 or even less than that. And so in this case, the demand is low because there's not that much awareness for it. The case where bot checkouts do create demand, I think would be for something like the Jound Club C or, you know, one of the nicer Jound shoes. If those dropped and bots took 100% of the stock and everyone missed and everyone is well aware of Jound and the stock was low, then they've created that demand. But not for this New Balance Bodega 990 V3, where stock was in the tens of thousands and the shoe kind of sucks. Overall, the article was good. Most of the points are good, and it did have a certain flow to it. But the kicker was wrong. Wet streets don't cause rain. Bot checkouts don't create demand for a shoe like the 990 V3 New Balance Bodega. If the shoe is nice and people want it, that's what creates demand. And the price will show that. That's been episode 23 of the Sock Jig Sneaker Podcast. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time. Go fuck yourself.